Well, welcome back, everyone. As mentioned, this is the public input portion of the informal hearing. And I'm going to turn it over to Matt. He is here on staff, and he will be walking people through the process to take public input. So we will do that. And then at the conclusion of the public input portion, we'll make a determination on whether or not to go back to the company representatives on any response, clarification, et cetera, that may be beneficial. So, okay, Matt, I'm going to turn it over to you, and we'll begin.
Okay, first on the list for public input is Jeanette Cutler, and I see they are in the open voice bridge, so I will just go ahead and unmute them and let them speak there. Hello, Jeanette.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, and I'm on a different line, but it doesn't matter. So, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So, I'm honored to be first up. This has been very interesting, and so I am thankful to AARP for making this happen. Like I said, it's been very educational for me. I tried to keep track of who everybody was, but Victor was a person that I was, is he a commissioner or?
Victor is a staff member. He's one of our analysts in the Public Utility Division.
Okay. Okay, thank you. So one of the perceptions I got from the commission is that eventually, one way or another, the ratepayers would be responsible for these increases. Does that make sense? We talked about kicking it down the future. We talked about a big part of the request for right now is the anomalies from the miscalculations historically. We've talked about how they've been defrayed over different time periods. But like I said, and then when we heard about Rob's expenses with the transmission line, there was always, I got the impression from the commissioners that eventually this would be put forth to the commission and would be approved, and ratepayers would be responsible for these expenses.
Well, I think there are two elements to consider. One, is the company entitled legally to recover expenditures? And the law is very clear in the fact that they are. That's something that has been set forth by the legislature, not only through the rider mechanism, but just through the utility rate regulation. But the second component is we make the determination as to whether or not those expenses qualify. And again, we apply the law. Are they recoverable? So we haven't made that final determination yet on whether or not this is or isn't recoverable. That doesn't occur officially until a vote is taken. But from my standpoint and from what staff has provided in terms of input and review, it's more a matter of timing, I believe, than it is on whether or not these expenses are actually recoverable.
Staff refers to the commission staff?
Correct.
Versus the company?
Right. We rely on commission staff. I certainly do. I would say it's fair to say that all the commissioners do that. We're looking at it from our perspective. We're looking at it from how does the law read, and do these expenses qualify?
Okay. One thing about Montana Dakota Utilities, it's a for-profit company, and it's pretty well known that the electric side is what generates the profits, the profitability within the organization themselves. And so coming from historically from the public sector, when there needed to be cost measures, cost things taken, you looked at maybe salary reductions, you looked at modifications that where the profit margin wasn't there, you cut back. And so with a public for-profit type of benefit where there's anomalies and miscalculations, and somebody did hit it off the nail on the head, why are current customers then, why are the ratepayers expected to pick up the expenses for the profitability of a company? And when they asked about like the federal money being used, that was a very good question. And when they asked about different type of programs that MDU might provide to their customers with energy use, I don't know that they're very solid. I've got properties and been a resident in under other utility holders where they do energy audits, and they're a lot more helpful. So I just don't exactly understand why the management of the company, or mismanagement or miscalculation, gets passed off automatically to the ratepayers. And I did follow Victor's recommendations if I didn't like the expenses or the cost to use less energy. But I don't know. Like I said, the perception I got from the commission was that eventually, one way or another, that the ratepayers would be responsible for the profitability of the company with their electricity generation and transmission.
You know, I would say generally, again, if the expenses qualify, based on how the law is written, and remember, we're a regulatory body. Our job is to apply the law. So we have to take that measurement first. But the other point, MDU is capped in terms of their rate of return. It's at 9.65% on the electric side, I believe. Is that correct, Victor?
Yeah, it's not a cap. That's what we set their authorized
rate of return.
Correct.
And we watch that very closely to make sure that they don't exceed and keep it as close as we can. And typically it's fairly close. And when it starts to decline, at some point in time, the company will, in all likelihood, come in for a rate case and have to review it at that point in time.
I'll just add to that. This is Victor with staff. So it's we're not guaranteeing the company any returns. We, per the law, we have to allow them an opportunity to earn a return. And we do that by setting rates on their rate base. And the rate base is really the expenses that they incurred, you know, to invest in transmission lines and power plants and things like that. Really, our opportunities to impact that is to tell them what types of those items we like them to invest in and which ones we don't. And beyond that, once we have said that this is this was money spent reasonably and prudently for the benefit of the public, then it's not a guarantee. It's an opportunity to earn that return. So if the company manages themselves well, they will earn that return, but if they don't, they may not.
Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Yeah, Janet, I think Commissioner Fedorchuk has something.
Just one other question for Victor along the lines. Do you recall in their last annual report what the rate of return for the utility was?
I don't.
Have they met it?
There's lots of numbers jumbling around my head. I'm pretty sure they had under collected from the 9.65 that they were granted.
So they under.
They generally in the last couple of years have under earned from that authorized level of 9.65.
And as a PSC staffer, when you evaluate and when the company looks at their under earnings, they can do a number of, they can decide to address it in any number of ways. The way that affects us is they might decide that they don't have enough revenues, which means they need to charge higher rates, and then they would come to us for a rate increase. But they could also reduce their costs as well.
They absolutely could.
And when they come to us for a rate case, we look at what their costs are and if they're reasonable.
You do.
And say, like, you know, no, we don't agree with that salary package or that approach to payments or retirement or, you know, all those various whatever the costs might be.
Yep.
Those are the things we look at in a rate case.
Yep. And generally in a rate case, there are those type of costs that we have, you know, in this rider proceeding, we're very limited. You know, we're talking about very specific resources that are set out in law that they can request recovery of. There's not a lot of leeway within this, whereas in a rate case, everything is up for grabs. So we generally will have at least a few different types of expenses that we will say, no, you know, we're not okay with customers paying for advertising for this, that, or the other thing, or some other type of expense, economic development, for an example. We will generally have a lot of those kind of things during a rate case where we'll say, no, ratepayers will not pay for that cost. The company can still do those things, but ratepayers will not be on the hook for it.
And by that, we mean you cannot bake that into your rates.
Exactly.
Which is this whole idea of rate base. That's what we base the rates on. So you can't count those advertising costs or those contributions to economic development programs. You can't count that in your rate base on which you can charge customers.
Correct.
Just all these terms that are not things that people use every day try to get your brain around when you're digging into these issues as a customer.
Correct.
Well, Janet brings up some very good points. I don't know if she's still on the line or you bring up some very good points, Janet, and I think they're the logical questions and ones that I'm quite certain many ratepayers have in terms of, you know, how do charges originate? What is recoverable? What isn't? You know, that ties back to statute. Victor just brought up the fact that a rate case is a different proceeding in the sense that there's more flexibility, I think, on the commission's part. And the case being the last rate case was a request of $13.4 million from MDU. And they were awarded $7.5 million at the conclusion of that rate case. So they certainly did not get everything that they were asking for. And it's you know, we work hard, frankly, at keeping a healthy balance between making sure they can provide reliable service, but at the same time trying to keep costs down for consumers. So it's a balancing act.
Just another quick point I think we should talk a little bit about, and that is this notion of the for-profit company and this rate of return. I think that's something that bothers customers quite a lot, and I can understand and appreciate that this allowable rate of return, it's not a guaranteed rate of return, which you already emphasized, Victor, but why should an investor-owned utility be able to make a rate of return or add an earning component to their costs? Why should they be able to do that?
It's in the law that we essentially have to do this, or I guess more so in case law that we have to allow them that opportunity.
Why is it in the law? Why is it justifiable?
In order to encourage them to do this, if the company, you know, any company, be it a regulated utility or publicly traded, private, whatever, they're in the business to make money. And if we don't provide them an opportunity to make money, then they'll go do something else. So,
and they being who? They're investors?
They're investors, yes.
Right. That's who the they is.
Correct. So we have to set that rate of return at a level that's high enough to attract investors such that they can make the investments necessary to ensure reliable, safe and reliable service.
And how's that different in a cooperative?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm appreciative that you're asking for this clarification and defining who the they is. I also had a question on whose case law it's based on.
Well, that's the legal guys to answer
one
that
of one. The legal people to talk about that.
It would be any applicable federal and state of North Dakota case law. Mostly, if it's dealing with, mostly it's going to be with state law of the state of North Dakota with these issues that are in our code and rules.
I happen to be taking right now another course in regulatory policy, and so a lot of these are questions that are gone over in those kind of courses, like the fundamentals. And I thought it's always good to revisit that stuff. This dates back to the 1800s when the regulation of utilities and the whole concept of public utilities first started in the U.S., and there's a lot of even Supreme Court case law over these issues, because quite honestly, at any point, if the company feels like we're not being fair in allowing them to recover the expenses that they have in order to provide the services to our customers, they can sue, come back and say this isn't appropriate, and they can overturn our decision in court, and then the court has to look and decide, is that a reasonable cost that the company incurred to serve its customers? If it is, they should be allowed to recover it with a earning. And then those cases go all the way up. And there's a lot of history in state and federal case law to address these issues.
I think getting to the heart, though, of why these publicly traded utilities, because we don't regulate co-ops, but we do regulate publicly traded utilities. And really, I think one of the most important points is the fact that they have monopolies on respective markets. They own the transmission. They have the distribution. They have their own generation. It's very difficult then for someone else to come in and compete on the same distribution system. A company's just not going to allow that. So if they weren't regulated with a reasonable rate of return so they can attract capital to do business at a low rate because they need to be a decent investment for the banking community, whomever, the investment community to look at, I think what would definitely, without question, happen, I think rates would skyrocket if they weren't regulated because they control markets. So that is one of the prime reasons why the regulatory the regulation was put in place to begin with, to protect consumers from monopolies on the utility side.
And your explanation shed a lot more light on things for me as well. I haven't been in Bismarck too awfully long, about 3.5 years. In the first 18 months, I was in an all-electric, in a co-op service area. And the price of the energy was much cheaper than I am now that I am in the MDU service area. So.
One other thing, Janet, regarding co-ops, and there's also municipal power providers in some communities have their own. I don't know that we have any in North Dakota. Valley City, maybe?
There are a couple. Grafton is as well.
Grafton, okay. So there's a few that are owned by the city, and those are regulated differently. The co-ops, they aren't regulated by the Public Service Commission. They aren't an investor-owned. They're cooperatively owned. So the theory is they're regulated by their members who own the company, in theory. So you elect a board of directors to represent you, and they are the quote-unquote regulators of the company. And so they aren't subject to our oversight, nor are the municipal power providers, because they are owned by the city who has elected leaders overseeing it. So the whole theory being, if you don't like what's happening, and then you can choose different leaders. They're the ones overseeing it and providing the quote-unquote regulations. So that's kind of the philosophy behind the various regulatory schemes and regimes that exist out there. And so that's why the Public Service Commission doesn't have authority over those other, like, cooperatives or municipally owned entities. As to why you pay more now than your other cooperative, we do look pretty closely at the rates that our investor-owned are paying as it relates to, or as it compares to the cooperative. And generally in North Dakota, I believe the investor-owned utilities are lower than the cooperatives, but maybe Jack or on par with them. It pretty closely aligned. There's not a huge discrepancy.
I think it varies a little bit. I would agree with that overall. The one thing that they're tough to compare in some sense is because, you know, a rural cooperative is covering more ground and versus a utility serving a large metro area where the distribution system is more condensed. So I think it depends. If you get into southwestern North Dakota, it probably costs more to distribute than a cooperative that is serving South Grand Forks, for example. But, Janet, you bring up some really, really good points and questions. Did you have anything else you wanted to ask us?
No, it's been so educational for me to participate and to listen in, and then your clarification, I just really have appreciated that. As a current ratepayer, though, don't think this is really good timing to pick up the burden of the expense for the historic anomalies and not being real crystal clear on what the future is going to bring. So I guess that's my two cents.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Janet. Really do appreciate your thoughts and your input. Very valuable. So, Matt, why don't we move to the next?
Sure. Okay. Next on the list is George Simic. I'll go ahead and dial them. Hello, is this George Simic?
Yes.
And you wanted to provide some input on today's informal with MDU?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, it's all yours, George. This is Commissioner Crassus. You can go whenever you're ready.
Okay. This is a very informational meeting. I learned a lot, and some of my questions were answered at. And one of the things was where the increase with rate would be used, and I can see it's going to be used in the projects that are ongoing right now in the western part of North Dakota. And another thing was I was wondering, is it just going to be residential or commercial included, or are municipalities also going to be included in that rate increase? And I was looking at their little sheet that they sent out with their monthly statement, and I see that the large and general contractors are going to have an increase as well as lighting. And that was one another question was, being a resident of Bismarck, on our utility bills, we get a fee that pays for maintenance and lighting. And I was just looking at that, and I thought, well, am I going to get hit twice on this increase on my home as well as on my bill on the street lighting? So I kind of questioned that, and I hope that it is. If the city gets built, they're going to just have it a pass-through thing to us residents here, so... and then the other question was, if this would be, would that be just a line item on our bill, so we could kind of watch it and see in 12 months if it's going to disappear or what it's going to be? So,
Okay. We'll have Victor follow up with you, but stay on the line, George. You might have some follow-up questions after Victor explains.
Yeah. So, George, this is Victor with staff. So, yes, all customer classes would be getting this increase. You know, so this is a line item on every electric bill with Montana Dakota Utilities. It's the transmission cost adjustment. I believe it says TCA, if memory serves, on your bill. So any customer class, which is all of them at this point, who receive that line item on the bill would see an increase. The amount of that increase will be different for the different classes, but it would be a similar percentage likely, the amount of the increase. Your question on the lighting, yes, you know, certainly if as a resident of Bismarck, I do believe Bismarck takes advantage of the lighting service that MDU does provide. So you would likely see that kind of wouldn't say it's a double charge necessarily, but you would be seeing two different sides of that as well. And your final question, I'm trying to recall what that was.
Projects. The projects in Western North Dakota.
The projects in Western North Dakota.
Yeah, I could see where they want their increase and where the money is going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Go to pay for the projects that are ongoing right now. So,
correct.
I was wondering if it was going to go out of state. You know, our increase was going to go to cover projects in other parts of the country or something like that. You know.
Some of it, yes. So MDU covers, you know, a multitude of more than just North Dakota. You know, we're certainly the biggest chunk of their territory, but that they do serve customers in Montana and South Dakota and even into Wyoming as well. So from time to time, they do have projects in those other states that we would pay a portion of. But similarly, you know, some of these projects we were talking about, you know, so the Dickinson one, you know, that project is located in North Dakota, but North Dakota customers are only paying approximately 70% of that project, where the other 30% is going to be paid by the customers of MDU in Montana, Wyoming, and South Dakota. So similarly, when there's projects in those states, we would pay a portion of those as well, provided it meets those kind of requirements we talked about. You know, if it's the voltage level is large enough and it's providing a benefit to more than just the local distribution system.
Victor, if I may too, maybe it'd be worthwhile to explain that we do break these down by jurisdictional shares though, and the staff does evaluate those costs per state and allocate that accordingly as well.
Yep, we absolutely do that. Thanks for the clarification. And then yes.
And Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Chrisman, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is Randy, and just to add on to that, if George, if you recall or got to hear that part of it, when we went through those six projects, they mentioned some of them as being more local, which they meant North Dakota, and where North Dakota consumers pay the complete cost of it. But I think three of them they referred to as being part of their overall system, the integrated system plan, and their North Dakota customers pay just 70% of it approximately because it's part of that integrated system that Victor was just talking about with the other states. Those other states' consumers pay for parts of it too. And then the other thing I wanted to just add, because it was partially addressed, as George mentioned, the municipal costs will get passed on to the residents there in the form of their taxes, I presume. And same with the commercial costs, because we'll all pay for those and the goods and services that those commercial users provide to stay in business. So yeah, it does trickle down. All these costs do.
Yeah, and George, so this is Victor again. So the we had talked a little bit about the MISO and SPP charges as well. So some of those charges would be for projects located outside of North Dakota as well. And those would be for MDU's usage of others' facilities.
in order to get power to MDU's customers. So some of that is likely located outside of North Dakota as well.
Yeah, I understand that. You know, there's no free will offering here. You got to pay for your service, you know.
Sure.
And I could, that's why I said it was very informational. Well, I didn't really understand what that was, but it sure, they really did explain how they belong to that power pool and how they have get credits by it, how much they use. I can see that. They use more, they maybe get more credit. So it's just like a dividend paying, buying from that company, or, you know, from different power pools. So yeah, it was very good. I enjoy it. I can see we have to pay for our services, and I don't feel that we need to deny it, but maybe it's not the right timing right now. So, but when is a good time, though? That's the other question that you know. So, but that's all I've got. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, George. And before we go to the next individual that will provide input, just for everyone listening, one of the things that we work very hard at is making sure that costs are allocated fairly so that North Dakota customers are not picking up more than they should have to pick up. And there's some give and take, but you know, at the end of the day, it's about, is it fair for North Dakota ratepayers? And that element of fairness is really at the top of the list each and every time on any rate case like this. So, Matt, we have...
last one up is Josh Eskvig.
Okay, and then just for anyone else listening, we will give the opportunity to, and you may have mentioned this, Matt, to do a virtual hand raise if someone else is called in. So, Josh, you're up next, and then we'll double check to make sure we've got everyone taken care of.
Josh.
Hello, Josh.
Hello.
This is Public Service Commission. You wanted to provide input.
There we go. Yep. Sorry, my Bluetooth wasn't connecting. Got it now. So.
All right.
Okay, Josh, it's all yours.
Commissioner Crosses, or Chairman Crosses, Commissioner Storchek, Chrisman, staff, and MDU. I wanted to start by, first of all, thank you for holding the public comment hearing on this transmission cost adjustment rider filing. I think the newspaper and other outlets have reported that it was a break in what you've normally done, and you mentioned that at the top, Mr. Chairman, and I think it's an important one. You know, we've had an unprecedented year in many, many aspects, and so I appreciate you guys taking the time to do it as part of it. Just for those who don't know, I think probably all of you do, but if there's folks listening online, Josh Eskvig, I'm state director for AARP North Dakota, and we advocate for North Dakotans 50-plus, as well as all residential utility customers in North Dakota and around the country. And many of our members take electric service from Montana Dakota Utility, and many MDU customers, including AARP members, are on lower fixed incomes. Others have lost their job or are suffering economically due to COVID-19. And an increase like this one here is too steep. And I think the extra diligence and explanation by MDU today was helpful. But I would say that the increase is still troubling because much of it is, as was just stated, and I think the question was spot on by the previous caller, George, about going to fund transmission upgrades in other states that are of limited or no benefit to North Dakota under the multi-value MISO transmission project plan. Additionally, the increase request also includes funding proposed for MDU projects not in service, and AARP has said and believed that projects not yet in service should not be recovered in a rider at this time, that perhaps the rate base would be a more appropriate for that type of cost recovery. And then last but certainly not least, the size of the increase is alarming. You know, I think, Commissioner Crosius, you outlining what's happened over the past period of time related to this rider was helpful and important to understand why, when we help consumers understand what was happening, you've gotten such a significant number of emails and people commenting. And if you followed online related to the news stories or on Facebook or even on our Facebook page, there's certainly been a lot of comments about why is this going up another $40 a year, and our members cannot afford another $40 per year. And part of that ties all the way back to the rate of return or the ROE that was authorized in MDU's last rate case. And I understand how it works. I think Commissioner Fedorchuk and Victor did a pretty good job of explaining the rate of return and that it's an authorized rate of return. And I think that, but it is too high given certainly the reduction in interest rates, especially during the pandemic, as part of it. The one other item I just wanted to note is that, you know, I think the questioning related to MISO was really important today, and I appreciate, commissioners, the questions you asked, because our belief is MDU is in the wrong regional transmission operator, and that's raising costs to customers. And we say that because, MDU takes its service from WAPA to serve much of its load, and WAPA is in the Southwest Power Pool, and MDU is in MISO, and so there's additional costs that would be eliminated if MDU simply joined SPP. And so we don't think there's a reason for MDU to stay in MISO. I think the last time we intervened in a rate case, we said that as well, and so we still believe that, and we think that's even truer since Basin and WAPA joined SPP. In any event, we think the PSC needs to signal that it expects MDU, as well as Xcel, Northern States Power, Otter Tail Power, and others to be more aggressive at MISO and in looking at proposals for new transmission spending, since MISO, as we've outlined and you've outlined, not we, you've outlined here, socializes those costs of new transmission lines to all members. And many or most of the projects are for states like Minnesota or others that have aggressive renewable goals that require such transmission spending. And as you are all well aware, I don't have to tell you this, for those listening, North Dakota doesn't have that goal. And we think that we should continue to be vocal in stating it does not benefit from, nor can it afford, such RTO authorized spending at a time like this. And so MDU and the North Dakota utilities in MISO should demand a low growth scenario be performed from MISO. Last, I just want to go back, and I know that they're authorized under statute to allow for surcharges such as the transmission cost adjustment, but as you know from previous comments we've made in rate cases and otherwise, other words, that we're not a fan of these. They often flow almost automatically through qualified spending without the opportunity to offset such spending requests with cost decreases. And these rate mechanisms are harmful to ratepayers, and we think blunt companies' incentives to act aggressively to control such costs. And so, again, I just appreciate the opportunity, and I thank the commission for taking this time. I think it was really important. And we've certainly been continuing to hear from our members and watching closely related to this, and do that. And so, again, thanks for the opportunity to comment. And we encourage you to continue to closely scrutinize this and other measures to avoid such jumps now and in the future.
You know, I'm going to just, thank you, Josh, very much. Appreciate your thoughts. Again, we certainly take them to heart and into consideration. And I don't think anyone would argue that that the timing isn't great. Less than ideal would be a good way of putting it. But at the same time, we're also trying to balance not creating a situation of extreme sticker shock down the road either. So it's something that we'll continue to discuss. But one thing about the projects, because I think sometimes when people see transmission projects either tied to costs related to MISO or SPP being in another part of the country as not benefiting North Dakota ratepayers, but it is an integrated system, of course. And when additions, an MVP project, for example, that originated in Ellendale, went to Big Stone, it was one of the MVP projects. Other states had to pick up the cost of that, a high percentage of that cost as well. So we're trying to create and watch to make sure that it's a fair balance and that these projects, because it is a multi-state integrated system, and I think that's hard for the typical average consumer to really get their arms around. But it's certainly something that we're watching intently at all times. Commissioner Fedorchuk?
Sure. Thank you, Josh. Appreciate you sitting through this morning and also weighing in with your thoughts. I also really appreciate you educating your members and getting ratepayers involved in learning about and caring about and expressing their interest in MDU's operations and business and charges. Couple things just in relation to your comments. So the your mentioning of not supporting customers paying for facilities that aren't fully operational yet. The technical term for what that is the allowance for funds used during construction. It's called AFUDC. I think you probably know that. And that is specifically allowed per the legislature. And so if you don't like that, you should make that known to the legislature because that's a provision that they've provided to the investor-owned utilities in North Dakota. So they are allowed to ask us for recovery of funds while projects are being constructed. They try to match the funds used for that year and come and collect those funds from the customers through the riders. I wholeheartedly agree with you in terms of the future transmission builds with MISO, and I know Randy probably agrees with you from the SPP side. Rest assured, we are working very hard. I probably spend half my time on MISO issues, and there is a lot going on with transmission builds right now, and you're hearing it. A lot of people in North Dakota who support future development of our renewable resources want more transmission, and that has to be balanced very carefully with the recognition, which I have, ingrained in my heart and my brain, that the people paying for that are the ratepayers. We just yesterday had a long meeting with some folks from South Dakota as well, just trying to get our heads together and make sure we have a strong position of to negotiate in MISO and with our fellow colleagues in other states on fair cost allocation for any future transmission builds. And I have strong feelings about that those not be put on the shoulders of North Dakotans unfairly. Also, I hope you heard some of the advantages, and we'll work to recognize those and communicate those, use those in your communications with your members, that there are benefits of being part of these power pools. And this is not something that has been done on a willy-nilly basis. It's something that we look at. It's something the companies look at. And there has been recognition that there is a net significant benefit to customers from being involved in these power pools. You heard Darcy Nigam talk about the fact that if it wasn't for being part of MISO, they would have to have a sizable additional generation resources that they own themselves and that only their customers would pay for. And those are significantly larger requirements for customers than the charges that they pay for transmission services in the power pool. And they also benefit from having the lower market price in the power pool that they're purchasing and reselling in. So that's something we look at, and it isn't, you know, we're not interested in being involved in things that have a high cost for customers without any benefits. We are just the opposite of that. So it's something we pay close attention to and want to make sure that it's of value to the customers that we're representing here. So those are my thoughts. Thank you very much.
Commissioner Crisman, did you have...
Just Commissioner Fedorchik, on your last point, we're not suggesting that power pools are not a good thing. We're suggesting that they're in the wrong power pool. So we're not saying RTOs are bad. We're suggesting it's the wrong one.
Yeah, I heard that, and I hope you heard their response to that, too, and that it would be more expensive for them to belong to SPP. So that's something we've evaluated as well, and we'll continue to keep an eye on.
Commissioner Crisman, I see your light is on. Do you have comments?
Yes, sir. And thanks, Josh, for being thorough and getting yourself informed on this topic matter that is not commonly understood because it's so unique. It is helpful to us and to society in general when you help make your members aware of a lot of these things. And I just want to say that another way you can help is, you know, when there are these projects, and a lot of them are important and necessary. Most of them should be built. But I think too often in recent years, our society has gotten to a point where too many leaders look at the utility industry as a sandbox where we can promote economic development and not have to take responsibility for it. And the responsibility ends up being with the utility regulators who have to pass the costs on to the consumers. And that's what we get here. So whether projects are occurring in North Dakota or somewhere else in either SPP or MISO, we need to look at them on the importance that they bring to the reliability and affordability over a long period of time to the electric grid. Not whether it's good economic development for that small area, because as we're seeing in this particular case, those economic development projects, when that's the only reason, while it's nice for the area, it gets spread out and is painful for the ratepayers. So again, appreciate your help on informing people of these things.
Josh, did you have any other thoughts you would like to share?
I just want to close again, Chairman Krosius, Commissioner Fedorchik, Commissioner Crisman. I want to emphasize, I think it's important what you did today in having this informal hearing and then offering this public input session. And, well, you certainly heard from a couple of folks. I think their points were on point, and I think others are probably listening and paying attention, and I don't think it's any secret that people are paying attention. And so I appreciate you doing your due diligence and really digging into this because it's important, and we'll continue to do what we can and weigh in where it's important to watch out for consumers as well. So thank you again.
Yeah, well, thank you. Appreciate it very much. Okay, now we'll do a quick check to see if anyone is on the phone bridge. So, Matt, you can give instructions.
Hello. If you're called in to the Open Voice Public Bridge and would like to provide some input, dial *9 for a virtual hand raise. Seeing none.
Okay, I don't believe we have anyone on the phone bridge. I had indicated that we might circle back to the company. I don't know if that would be necessary or not, but I'll give the company the opportunity to do a close if they wish, or if they are done presenting, that that is fine as well. So anyone from MDU that would like to provide any closing thoughts? Carl, I see you're live.
Yeah, Commissioners, Carl Liebitz here. Maybe a question as to the record. We opened with an informal hearing, and generally that was just parties to the proceeding. And then we took a break and then transitioned to a public input session. I guess our expectation, and maybe Mr. Hsu could weigh in, but our thought is that the informal hearing part of it would be part of the formal record. And then comments from the public, of whom are not parties to the proceeding, would not be part of the formal record. And so that's how we're thinking about it, but welcome input from Mr. Hsu or others. The record would reflect today's combined session, if you will.
Sure. I can speak to generally public input is not part of the electronic record upon which the decision is normally made. However, if the commission would like to move that into the record, they certainly could. I know as it is right now that it's currently being recorded together, so it would require some separation, and that was a bit of an oversight. So I guess I would leave up to the commissioners to make a decision on that.
Do you have thoughts?
Does the company object to it being part of the record?
Yeah, I think, Commissioner, this is Carl again, that members of the public aren't, we don't have an opportunity, obviously, to cross-examine. They're not, sworn in like you would in a hearing environment. No rebuttal testimony, so no outright objections to what was discussed, but it doesn't seem appropriate to have non-party input as a formal part of the record. And that's, my perspective.
Sure, and I guess to follow up with that, if the commission did like to move it in the record, it would seem appropriate to allow the company an opportunity to file a rebuttal if they so chose.
Commissioner Christman, would you like to weigh in? I see your light is on.
The light being on was an oversight, but I'll say we have to maintain consistency from one case to another. Can always be exceptions, but generally we try to be consistent, and there'll be future cases that it just might not be a good idea, I think, to start making in the middle of cases public input a part of the official record, just by calling in like this. So I think that this part of it should be kept separate in the public input file in case.
And if I may, there's one additional reason why we may want to separate that into the electronic record and the public input is we have received a number of public inputs outside of the actual oral testimony or oral comments today. We have written comments as well, and those would be getting different treatment from that aspect. So if we would like to maintain consistency with how we treat all public input as you evaluate and make your decision, it probably would not be part of the electronic record.
I would agree with that, having that separation, but including the comments we received from Janet, George, and Josh as a part of the public input that the commission does receive. I think that would be consistent, but keeping the electronic record to the informal hearing itself. One of the thoughts on doing it this way, and we heard it, I think, from several or if not all three people that provided input, that hearing the process, the proceeding was very helpful in them being able to understand what this process is all about. I think otherwise, prior to the process occurring, you get snippets where the public is provided just a part of the picture, and it's hard for them to appropriately weigh in and really know what's driving this. So this was taking input after I felt a better explanation was provided, and I think we accomplished that as we heard in their their comments. Unless there are objections, I think keeping that separate from the official record, but certainly within the public input received would be appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with that, but I just want to make a couple comments if any of the public is still listening. This is where things get more technical and formal mm-hmm. and process-oriented than I think folks in the outside might just view it not as being as common sense. But we are a quasi-judicial body, and we have, you know, pretty formal rules of evidence and legal processes that we have to follow and be consistent with over time. And so, but from the standpoint of public, the public input, I want to assure the public that did participate that your input and the questions that you offered in advance and the input that you provided in writing to us certainly did inform myself and I'm sure my colleagues in the questions that we asked here today, and to that extent is very much a part of the public or the quote-unquote official record. And so it's very helpful to have you involved in your input matters, and whether it's deemed officially part of the record or not, it's still baked in through the questions that we asked and the conversation that we had with the company. So very valuable and important in the end as well. So thank you.
Commissioner Christman, any closing comments?
No, that's it.
Okay. Well, at this point in time, a number of thank yous, three in particular. One, thank you to those who called in and again provided comments. Thank you to the company for providing the presentation during the informal portion of the hearing. And I will close that out officially here in just a second, but also thank you to staff. I don't have my official notes, so I'm going to do this from memory. Hopefully I get it right. The audio recording as well as the presentation provided by the company will now be a part of the official record upon which a decision will be made. Are there any objections to that evidence becoming a part of the official record from the company?
No objections. Just clarifying, you know, prior to the break and during the informal session.
Yes, that is correct. The official record will be up to the break and not include the public input portion as mentioned. Staff, any objections?
No objections.
No, I would like to make one point of clarification, though, even though it is in part of the actual electronic record, part of the legal record, it still will be docketed mm-hmm. and available.
Correct. Yes. Yes. Yeah, no, it was very important feedback. So, all right, then the audio recording as well as the presentation, the PowerPoint presentation, is now considered evidence and will be used in the making in the official decision. I want to thank everyone again for their participation. It was about a little over three hours, so we covered a lot of ground. But thank you, everyone. Appreciate it. And the follow-up items, as mentioned, Victor, you had mentioned those earlier. One was, well, there was four, I believe. Can you go through those again?
So we were going to have an alternatives with passing back the under-collected balance over 2 years. Mm-hmm. One alternative where we hold the entirety of that until next year. And then two variations of each of those with implementation, well, actually, I suppose three variations. Implementation dates, November 1, December 1, and January 1 for each of those, just depending on how long until we get an official decision. And then just kind of as an aside to that, if I could ask the company to specify what the last date that they can receive our approval and be able to implement rates. So, for example, in order to implement as of November 1, what is the last date that you could be that we could approve that for you to implement on November 1, and similarly for December and January as well.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
To that point on implementation and kind of the timing of this, which is somewhat time sensitive in order to mitigate additional rate impacts, would it be possible or advisable for us to set a work session, like a deadline for the company's exhibits and our, like today, set a work session for when we're going to get together and try to wrap this up or talk about it so we can get it on a future meeting agenda?
Yeah, we talked about that. Maybe this is completely unrealistic, but I don't know if it would be possible to have these elements. This probably isn't, but by noon on Tuesday, it's probably a great stretch. But I'm thinking about, short of the timing still being with the November 1st implementation date, we have one commission meeting coming up next week. Correct. And after that, we have one following on November 11th. So
would you anticipate getting the filings and having an order ready for Wednesday? Seems a little tight.
It seems really tight, but I'd also prefer not to go to a special meeting. And
I can have an order ready. I mean, that's not going to take me very much time, and then just plug in whatever numbers we come up with. But yeah, to have adequate time for you all to review what the company files, that's kind of the big question mark, I guess. The first question is for the company, how long do they need to file this,
right,
this information?
Right.
Thanks, Victor. Tuesday at noon would be tight, but I really think it can be done. So we could probably get you that information by Tuesday at noon.
Okay. I mean, we'd have to be able to have a work session scheduled Tuesday afternoon at that point in time to. And again, it is time sensitive. That's the reason. It isn't that this has been predetermined. We still have to talk about it. But sooner, assuming some form of approval, is definitely better for ratepayers. Commissioner Crispin, do you have thoughts?
I can do that if the company and the staff can do that, and then if when we get into a work session to actually discuss it, if we agree that quickly.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of ifs, and it.
We could sure try if the company and staff can be ready for us to have a discussion on Tuesday afternoon. Mm-hmm.
I think the dates of implementation will probably be, in terms of those three scenarios, to me, the two components I'm going to, well, I guess that factors in, but the two components, one would be the potential to either spread the under-recovered balance out over 2 years, or whether or not to defer it until the following year.
Right.
So. Well, let's shoot for that. Keep us posted, Travis. And I know it's a very tight window, and we want it to be right, of course. So
I will put a motion on the agenda for this item, just as a placeholder. And then if we don't end up getting to an acceptable order for everyone, we'll just pull it.
Okay.
I'll in the meantime draft up that order and send out kind of that preliminary draft to the three of you, just for the language stuff, if you want to take a look and see if you are okay with all of that, and then I'll modify numbers and things like that based on the work session.
Okay.
Can we set a work session time too?
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. We can certainly go into scheduling. So,
but Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, yes.
Before we do that, if we still have people that haven't worked on these kinds of things in the past that are listening in, this doesn't mean that when we talk about getting an order done and everything, that it's just rubber stamping what MDU had asked for. This is our process because of open records requirements. We can't really just call each other on the phone or something and discuss this case. We need to get all the things, the further information that we've asked for in front of us, and then we'll have this work session, which will be an opportunity where the press or people could be there, and we'll discuss it to get to what we want the order to say, but we need something to start with, and so people should understand that.
Mm-hmm. We could add the order to the agenda when and if we have one, even
yeah.
if it's late.
Yeah,
that's fine.
I think that seems a little premature at this point.
Okay.
But let's still continue, without adding it, continue on having a draft ready would be great. We'll see how the company can progress with some of the information. And then how does 1 or 1:30 work on Tuesday for...
Works for me.
Randy, how does that work for you?
That works for me too, but I will also say that later in the afternoon would also work. And if the company is going to get information in by noon on Tuesday, we might not have had very much opportunity to contemplate it before our work session if we meet at 1. But it's either any time in the afternoon
yeah.
would be okay.
I think the numbers will be pretty straightforward. I mean, 2 o'clock, should we just change it a little bit, 2 o'clock?
I'd like to have a little time to review what the company provides just so that we aren't doing that while we're meeting. So 2 or 3, I think, would be great.
Okay, well, to be safe, why don't we just plan on 3 o'clock then? It sounds like that would work for everyone here on staff. So 3 o'clock Tuesday, we'll have a work session on this. On the condition that the company is able to provide the information as quickly as we're hoping, and again recognizing that it's a big request. So, okay, thank you, everyone. I think that's a wrap. So, thanks all.
Thanks.